Previously on Documenta and Son.
Thank you, Sondheim, for everything you gave us. My life, truly, there are so few artists, people working in culture that I can say this about. My life truly would be different and worse without what he gave us. May his memory be a blessing.
Hello, and welcome to Documenta and Son, being the adventures of a dad who's gay and a son who's figuring shit out. My name is Documenta Barbarism, a document of barbarism.
And I'm Dingle Mary, a selection of cheeses, comma, bread.
What? Was that on a menu or something?
Yeah, it was the description for a menu item at La Prette. Fancy name or
Le Pain Quotidien.
Yeah, that
Le Pret fancy name.
Yeah, I realized that Pret is a different, not fancy place, but still tasty.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the stage Le Pret fancy name.
Wait, but that's actually kind of a good track name.
I know.
Like low key.
All right, well, my chair is not cooperating, so you may be hearing chair noises all night. Sorry about it. So, Dingle, how are you?
I'm doing good.
Are you?
Yeah.
Good. I'm glad to hear it.
Mm-hmm. Tomorrow, we have the next GSA meeting, and I still do not know if I'm treasurer.
That's been quite a saga.
Yeah, so hopefully we'll learn tomorrow.
Okay, cool. You only had one meeting in November.
Yeah. And it was 2 hours long to compensate, but I didn't know this, so Dad came up to pick me an hour early.
45 minutes early because I came 15 minutes late to pick you up because I wanted you to have plenty of time to talk to your friends because I'm an amazing father.
Right. High fives. And now that we've broken your eardrops.
Thanks for listening. So we're not playing trivia today. I wanted to just sort of check in for a bit. Not sort of check in. I wanted to fully check in. We haven't really talked about anything meaningful on the pod in a while.
Dad is looking for me crying on the pod today.
No, definitely not. Actually, I'd prefer if you didn't.
Because that means something is wrong.
Yeah. No, actually, but if tears come, that's fine. But no, I'm truly not. It's just, if you want to read about him crying, go read our interview in Signal House Edition.
It's available on all his socials.
We just haven't talked about, real or meaningful stuff in a while. I just wanted to check in and see how you're doing. Partially because when we were in the city the other day, you were on a mood roller coaster.
To say the least.
You were on a torrid cyclone of emotion all day long, which is part and parcel. It's the prerogative of all adolescence. It's to be expected.
One of the initial bad moods started mostly because I didn't like the salad dressing at
the
lunch,
the salad what?
Which was further just inflamed by the fact that I kept calling it salad sauce.
This salad sauce is gross. Hey, stop it. Oh, God, the fucking salad sauce. And I get it. We were both hungry by that point because we had already walked all over Soho looking for a fucking brunch place.
I know.
We went to Baz Bagel, which was sadly not dine-in, which is the whole point of going to Baz Bagel is to sit at the counter and enjoy the awesome atmosphere. And I guess there's just not a good brunch in Soho unless you are super rich and or have made reservations. I don't know. Let us know if there is. But we did end up at Le Pain Quotidien, which is actually not bad.
Yeah, I liked the sandwich I got.
Yeah, the croissant, right?
Ham and Gruyere croissant sandwich, yeah.
But not so crazy about the salad sauce.
No, that salad sauce was gross, to say the least.
Hold on. You're going to hear a bumping noise now because I'm just going to let my chair slide all the way down because it's driving me crazy. 3, 2, 1.
Blast off.
Okay, well, I was pretty much already on the floor by that point.
It was less of a bump and more of a poof.
That's the title of my autobiography. less of a bump, more of a
The first one's already sad, and then the second sound is so much sadder.
Yeah, the pathetic life of documented barbarism. But we had a lot of fun in the city still, mm-hmm. but we were in there for quite a long time. So we had a novel's worth of emotions in one day.
The whole day basically had a 3-act structure. It was long enough for that.
5-act, bitch.
5-act.
Yeah. It wasn't Ibsen. It was Shakespeare.
Don't make fun of me. I just took ibuprofen.
Sorry.
I don't know why that means anything.
Sorry, Evie Oddly. Well, for me, the roller coaster of emotion revolved around that neon pink Alexander Wang bag.
I forgot about the Alexander Wang!
I wish I could, but I've been thinking about it nonstop. I had convinced myself that I was okay not getting it, and I mostly am. It was this beautiful, just little neon pink bag, Alexander Wang, which was right across the street from the Pan Quotidien, mm-hmm. right? So we went in. I'm sure they were like, who are these fucking posers? But we didn't care. And they had this beautiful little neon pink bag, which you can't even buy online anymore. It's 30% off. It still was, I mean, it's not like I should not be buying $350 bags, you know? It's not like even a higher-end bag, but it was so pretty and so pink. Although it did have that weird closed, like, drawstring top that you had to just, like elastic to close.
Really?
Which is actually kind of ugly. So that made it okay. But it was this beautiful shade of neon pink that you kind of can see all over right now that I love, which is great because it's, like, the color that I want everything to be in. But I have still, by the end of the day, if you remember, I had told myself that I was glad I had it and convinced myself that I'd made the right choice. And I still believe that up here in my head, but not down here in my penis. No, I'm pointing at my heart. So that's, but overall, yes, I'm glad because I have to, you know, be wise and make smart grown-up adult decisions. But God, that beautiful bag just haunts my dreams.
I fell for the penis joke, hook, line, and sinker, by the way.
Enough about me. Let's talk about you for a minute. Enough about you. Let's talk about life for a while. The conflict. Okay, I'm sorry. We were talking about your mood. Actually, no, we don't have to talk about anything you don't want to talk about, but I just want to see how are you doing overall?
Well, my mood swings generally revolve around this like puffy coat at Alexander Wang.
Oh shit, I did bring up the position of
that mentioned. Dad like looked at it and was like, "Oh, this is 40% off." And he like held it up to me and he was like, "Oh yeah, that could fit you." And I was like, oh, "Please get me this Alexander Wang coat." And then he never did, and then he was like so adamant the rest of the day about there was never any chance of you getting that coat, and I was so angry.
Right,
I felt betrayed in that.
There
moment.
Was never a chance. I guess I was trying to make the point that you could wear, it's not couture, I suppose. I don't really know. Is Alexander Wang couture? I assume
sure
it is.
I'm not sure what couture means.
I mean, it means like not off the rack, sort of, but
well,
that was hanging on a rack.
It was hanging on
a rack. So I don't really know, but it was far more, it's expensive than, far more money than we usually spend on clothes because
I wanted it.
Well, get a good job.
It.
And then as soon as you've paid off my student loans, you can start buying puffy coats from Alexander Wang.
He made the same comment on Saturday.
Oh, I did?
Yeah.
Yeah, because I need some fresh material. Mm-hmm. But that was a cool puffy coat, definitely. Puffy stuff is in, or I mean, I'm noticing it, so I assume it was probably in like a few seasons ago.
Yeah.
And I'm just noticing it. It's really cool. But yeah, we survived Alexander Wang.
Barely.
Just how do you feel, though? Like, for real, like... Be real a minute. Are they making you feel some type of way, or?
I mean, when I think about it, I do get sad that you won't be coming out to visit mom for Christmas. Which is, I know, I've had a few months now to work up that, and I think I've come mostly to terms with it. It still gets me sad, like, of course it does, but, you know, it's fine. I'm just sort of, I'm consoling myself by letting myself know that I'm not going to get you a Christmas gift.
Fuck you. Actually, yeah, like, how would that be different from any other year, literally?
I got you the Lord of the Rings biography about the making of it with Peter Jackson for Christmas.
Who got me the Peter Jackson book?
I thought of it when I saw you, and then Mom paid for it at Barnes & Noble.
Right, exactly.
But it was my choice.
But, okay, but, you know, stop going to comedy. Like,
I'm just embracing my inner mechanism. Cary Grant.
What, did he use comedy as a defense mechanism?
Yeah, he, like, rarely went with dramatic roles, because that would force him to embrace his inner Archie Leach.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, spoiler alert. But the times where he does... a lot of the people involved, at least in the biography that I'm reading, said that his performance was very powerful. So
when he was dramatic?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we'll get into it, but have you seen any of his dramatic roles? Mm-hmm. I don't think you have. Yeah, he's so good in Suspicion. He's so creepy. Okay, but anyway, I know you're just trying to change the subject, trying to 180 your way out of this.
I thought that was a good segue.
We're talking about Cary Grant last on the episode. So, yeah, it's a good segue, except that it wasn't. It was so good, it was bad. So, but why does it make you feel bad that I'm not going to be out in Utah for Christmas?
Well, because even over the previous holidays when your divorce was being finalized, you know, we still hung out for the holidays and spent that Christmas together. So, and this is just going to be, like, the first one that we have where you're both divorced and not... And we're not all hanging out for the holidays, which I think is going to be tough.
So it's finally going to be a real child of divorce experience.
Yeah, exactly.
The whole separate holidays, separate everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. It was nice last Christmas when it was just the three of us in Dingle Mommy's new apartment.
Yeah.
And then on her birthday when we went up to... Spiral Jetty, remember? That was fun, just the three of us. And then when she was out here in October.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, there's nothing really, you know, I'm sorry. There's nothing really to say about that except get over it. No.
God.
No, I'm sorry. Okay, now I'm doing it. There's nothing to say about that except that I'm sure it will just get easier the more you do it. You know, I can't really guide you through this because as I've already bragged about, on microphone, my parents are divorced. Nanny, nanny, poo, poo. But, and I would, you know, I would love to be out there with you too, but I think it's also important that we begin to actually do what the divorce decree says. Because, you know, it is law.
Supposedly.
But we just begin to figure out, you know, feel our way through what it actually means to do things, you know, separately.
Yeah.
And then we see, you know, because it doesn't make us any less of a family unit necessarily. Maybe it does. I don't know. We'll see. We'll see how it goes. But I'm glad you'll be able to be around all the family out there and stuff. Mm-hmm. That'll be fun.
I am too.
You won't even notice I'm not there. You'll be having so much fun with all your little cousins and whatnot. If you live in the greater New York area or have a good microphone and would like to share your story on Closet Practice, anonymously or not, message me on Twitter at DocumentaBee, on Instagram at DocumentaBarbarism, online at DocumentaBarbarism.com, or by email to buttstuff@DocumentaBarbarism.com, with only one A in barbarism. That's DocumentaBarbarism. In the meantime, be sure to subscribe to House of Barbarism on your pod thingy of choice so you don't miss a single episode of Adventures in Gay Sitting and Closet Practice every Monday, and Documenta and Sun every Thursday. Okay, campers, today we are talking about probably the straightest artifact we will ever be talking about on this podcast, the new Broadway musical Flying Over Sunset. Flying over sunset, la-di-da-di-da.
Good morning, campers. I'm only thinking about Gigi Good from now on because you killed the listeners' campers.
Flying over sunset. Don't you agree that this is probably the straightest thing we will ever talk about?
No, it really is. The only reason we saw it is because Cary Grant is one of the characters.
Yes, pretty much.
And they don't even mention his queerness at all.
Oh, yeah, we're going to get into that. But, yes, we are also introducing a new, it's not really a segment, but a new ongoing topic that we will return to every once in a while called Bicons. Other working titles include Let Bicons Be Bicons and others that are escaping me right now.
Biconic?
Biconic, yes. Biconic. Yeah.
I do want to say, give credit where credit is due, I came up with the original Bicons.
Congratulations. Maybe Biconic, yeah.
I do like Biconic. Biconic is good.
Okay, we'll see. Yeah. Anyway, because Dingleberry is in his bi phase.
You can hear the air quotes, I hope. And just know that they piss me off so much.
Oh, I wonder if that's why I do it.
Like, I don't know. I'm rethinking my sexual identity just so Dad will stop making fun of it.
In which case, my plan is working.
Oh, that is a terrible... That is a terrible... Oh, Nor.
So, yes, or this week's Bicon is, of course, Cary Grant, who is a character in the musical Flying Over Sunset.
Flying Over Sunset.
La-di-da-di-da. Which...
garbage music.
Which was... Look, I want to acknowledge the wonderful privilege we have of even being able to go to the theater. You know, it's something that I only dreamed of as I was growing up, way on the other side of the country, going to finally getting to go to New York and see Broadway shows for the first time when I was 17 was a huge and revelatory moment for me. What?
What was your first? It's escaping my mind.
Well, we saw touring shows, which were, you know, Broadway. My very first, like, Broadway
on Broadway
show. Well, I was going to say Broadway style, like, equity size, like, touring show.
I have to stop interrupting you.
Yeah, you really should. That's okay. It's so, to be honest, sometimes it's the only way you can get a word in edgewise.
No, it's true.
It was Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat.
Really? That's funny. Uh-huh.
We saw, and so we lived in southeastern Washington in the middle of nowhere, so we would have to go to either Spokane or Seattle to see shows. Mm. We went to Joseph, and we just saw mostly ones like that when I was in high school. Joseph, Cats, Phantom of the Opera, Les Mis, Phantom we saw in Seattle. But that was pretty much all I had seen. My first Broadway show on Broadway was one I had actually already seen, which was Les Mis. Because I won this speech contest and won a tour of the East Coast with this, like, this bus tour with a bunch of other high school students from Washington.
That's right. I remember that now.
Yeah, it's badass. We went to Niagara Falls, D.C., Philly, Boston.
Whoa, wait. That's sick, though.
Yeah, it was amazing. We were in Canada, the Canadian side of Niagara Falls, on July 1st, which is their Independence Day. So we got to see fireworks over the falls. Then we were in Boston on July 4th to see John Williams and the Boston Pops and fireworks there in Boston.
Fireworks extravaganza eleganza. Hey.
And I had gone basically nowhere in my life at that point. So to go to all these places was like, whoa, there's a whole world out here. But all of this is which to say that even being able to go to Broadway shows still feels like an immense and wonderful privilege to me that I'm so grateful for, especially after the shutdown.
Yeah.
And after all that time without it, you know, it's wonderful to be able to do this.
Yeah.
That said, this was the most boring play I can ever remember seeing. Ever. 2 hours and 45 minutes of pure, excruciating, butt and mind numbing hell.
It was so long.
And I say the most boring that I can remember because I don't remember everything I've seen. I've seen quite a bit. Not as much as many people, you know, in the last 20 years, but I have seen quite a bit. And I've seen a lot of really horrible shit.
Would you say you've seen as many as you want to see?
No, never. I will die not seeing nearly as many as I would like to have seen. But that's okay. But not soon. Don't worry.
Okay, thank God.
But I cannot remember being this bored. Even accounting for it was at the end. It was the second show we had seen. It was a very long day. We had walked all over.
It started at 8 p.m.
It started at 8 p.m. You know, even accounting for all of that, I was just awed. at how boring and unengaging and uninteresting it was. But before we get too deep into our critique, we'll talk about the play first and then talk a little bit more about Bicon, about the Biconic Cary Grant.
Woo! Jazz hands!
So, do you want to give a quick synopsis? Oh, what?
I was about to say, he doesn't really do jazz hands because he was apparently a terrible singer and a middling dancer.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
But he was a good stilt walker, right?
Yeah, he was a good stilt walker and he was good at vaudeville. But
like juggling and stuff?
Yeah, like dexterity and comedy stuff. But yeah, he did one musical movie and apparently he was garbage.
All of them in the Golden Age did at least one musical movie.
Yeah.
What was it? Do you remember?
If you gave me time to scroll through the book...
I will not.
Okay.
Why don't you give a quick synopsis of Flying Over Sunset?
Okay, so Flying Over Sunset...
La-di-da-di-da!
...is about three people, one of which is Cary Grant.
Actually, it's about four people, which is another thing that annoys me that we will get into. They sideline the gay character.
They really do.
But the official synopsis is, yes, it's about three people.
Cary Grant.
Real people.
Yes, real people. Cary Grant,
Aldous Huxley,
and...
Claire Booth Luce.
They're all going through pivotal moments in their life. Cary Grant is considering retirement. Aldous Huxley just lost his wife. And Luce Booth.
Claire Booth Luce. Who had sounded like she had a screw loose.
Booth
Luce had a screw loose.
Booth Luce was going to be a...
Stop saying it like that.
Claire. I'm going to call her Claire from now on.
Great.
Claire turned down
Ambassadorship to Brazil, I think.
Yes,
wasn't
ambassadorship.
It?
That's the word it's looking for. Ambassadorship to Brazil, and she is rethinking that decision.
Yeah, why did she just because? And she's having because, marital problems.
Yeah, I think it's because of her marital problems. She doesn't, or maybe she feels as if the governmental jobs aren't for her anymore because she used to be a screenwriter.
Yeah, a playwright and stuff.
In any case, they've
to be honest, the motivations and the dramatic. Problems were quite muddy, and
yeah.
I wasn't actually sure most of the time what problem they were dealing with
at
any given moment.
That's true. But they all, for some reason or other, have started taking LSD for medical purposes. The first act is their like first experiences with LSD and development of their problems, and then it ends with all of them meeting at a restaurant, including the gay character. And deciding to go take LSD together, which is Act 2. It's them all taking LSD together. While this is based on real people, this is not a real event, right?
Right. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
They don't know that... So the fourth character, the gay character, Gerald Hurd, also a real person. He was the one that was more connected to this whole alternate psychotherapy, psychedelic, spiritual, Eastern... thing movement.
Yeah, he introduced like Claire and Aldous to LSD.
Yeah, because in real life he did run in both of their social circles, so he really was. Yeah. That was the connection between them, at least. And then Cary Grant that was also did LSD once
and was at a restaurant.
And so yeah, this they're just like, hey, look, there's Cary Grant. I met him before. Hey, Cary, come on over here.
And then he's like, in the most, please no. And then they're like, do it. And then he's like, fine. And then he came over for a drink, which is like...
Yeah. God, it was just so dead, just so inert. There was a friend of mine who I do not want to mention by name, who I went to high school with, who is a Tony Award winning actor.
Yeah. I know exactly who you're talking about.
Yeah, you do. Who has worked with James Lapine. James Lapine wrote the play.
Mm.
And
the book?
The book. Yeah, he wrote the libretto. And he also wrote, like, Sunday in the Park with George, Into the Woods, Passion. He's also responsible for making Sondheim boring.
Ooh. Wait, he did Into the Woods?
Uh-huh.
I
know. Can you believe it?
What a disappointment.
And that, I chalk up the success of Into the Woods to the fact that it's just interlocked fairy tales.
That's true.
And honestly, his wife came up with a lot of the conceit of that, too. Like, it was her idea to have the characters sing about how their experiences that happened off stage had changed them. And she apparently had quite a lot of input into that libretto too.
Whoa.
And Passion is good because it's an adaptation.
Oh no!
of a film. So the story was already in place.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, no.
And Sunday in the Park. I've already shared my feelings on that. He's done a lot of plays, a lot of musicals. He did falsettos with William Finn, which I actually quite like, even though, again, it's not really particularly dramatic. Anyway, this friend of mine who worked with Lapine on a play said that he literally said to the cast at one point in rehearsals that conflict is not necessary for drama. Which he may actually have a point. You know, there are as many types of drama as there are people in the world. There's nothing, even though people think that because Aristotle decreed that things were this way 2,000 years ago, that's how things must be. But he was just describing what he saw. You know, there's nothing that says drama has to be this way.
That goes against everything I've learned in my English writing lessons.
Yeah.
And my D&D campaigns.
Yeah, totally.
I'm going to make a D&D campaign where they're all pacifists.
You should. But see, that's the thing, is that it's not... You can make a drama about pacifists. Like, that's...
Yeah.
That's the thing, is even when... And, you know, some of our best playwriters... I sound like one of my students. Playwrights.
Play authors.
Have talked about how... I'm thinking of Susan Laurie Parks, of Sarah Ruhl. They've talked about how they're trying to move beyond this Aristotelian form of drama where it's all based on conflict, because that's a very masculine form. It's a very capitalistic form, right? Mm-hmm. So yes, I see that and I understand that. And yet, to have this A-list playwright believe that conflict is not necessary for drama just boggles the mind. And it shows, because there is no conflict in this play.
There is no conflict.
There were occasionally conflicts between characters, but they were shouty arguments that were then quickly resolved.
Yeah, by LSD.
By LSD, or just by moving on.
Or by...
Which means that the whole first act is just long scenes in which they take LSD, and then we learn things about their past, or what they're going through.
Yeah.
Which is fine. That can be something like that can be done. I'm thinking of, it reminded me a lot of the musical Lady in the Dark from the 40s.
Never heard of it.
By Kurt Weill and if I keep saying and doing this motion with my hands, I'll pull the names. And Ira Gershwin and Moss Hart.
That was genuinely surprising.
It was pretty revolutionary. It's also about therapy.
Oh.
It was when psychotherapy was really becoming a thing in the, you know, in the 30s and 40s. But it's not a traditional musical in that all of the, except for the very last song, all of the songs are contained within three self-contained dream sequences, which she describes to her therapist.
Whoa, that's really cool.
Yeah, it's badass. You know, it's ideas of psychotherapy. Its Freudian ideas are pretty crude by today's standards.
That's really cool.
But it's awesome, yeah. And so there isn't necessarily conflict within those. You know, they create these beautiful, you know, it's really, really suggestive and, what's the word I'm looking for, you know, about dreams? Not surrealist necessarily, but... Not symbolist. I mean, if I keep saying and doing this motion.
It's the kind of art that I always say is the only kind of art I can draw.
Abstract?
Yeah.
It's expressionistic, I think, is what okay. I was looking for. And yet, because it's just, at the very least, it's within each segment, it still works towards a dramatic goal. Whereas in this... The whole point of the three long scenes that make up the bulk of Act One are just about exposition, just telling us who these characters are.
Which is, it's just so dull to have an hour and a half of exposition.
It truly is.
God.
And then when they all meet, they just sit in a booth at the Brown Derby and talk.
Yeah.
And they just have a and the dialogue is just like, "Hi, how are you? Nice to meet you. He just lost his wife. Oh, I'm so sorry." Like, literally, it's just the flattest, least interesting, least suggestive.
It's like somebody making a joke about the lack of real conversation in today's modern society.
Yeah.
Or something like that, but I don't think it was meant to be.
No, of course it wasn't.
So
it was just so inert. And I could tell from, you know, a couple minutes in that we were in trouble. It actually starts out really cool. What I will give props to is the sound design.
The opening scene is so cool. Like the opening, like, mini number, it's so cool.
I will give props to sound design by Dan Moses Schreier and the choreographer.
Choreography.
Who is, I know her name, and Michelle Dorrance. Because it starts out with just a single character walking on stage, and you realize that they're walking in rhythm. They've got hard soles on their shoes, and so this whole opening number, people get added in, and so it's choreography, but it's also percussion, doing percussion with the feet.
Yeah.
Some of them start doing that, the sand walk from Dune, like sliding their feet around.
Yeah, to do like a shh.
Yeah. And it was cool. And you feel like, okay, this is going to be awesome. And then it goes nowhere. Then it just ends.
Yeah, it sets itself up so well, which I think adds to its disappointment, is that it starts out in such a cool and strong scene that just falls flat.
Yeah, it just goes nowhere.
Yeah.
And then it just starts. I read an interview with her, watched some videos with her. And the stuff that they were trying to do was really interesting, the way they were trying to use sound to suggest the emotional landscape, but also to suggest the subjectivity of going on an acid trip. So the way the choreography worked with the sound design was actually really interesting. Mm. And I think the strongest part.
Yeah.
I mean, the sets were beautiful. They always are at Lincoln Center because they've got so much money to throw at it.
Yeah, there are so many things on wheels and engines.
Just these huge, huge staircase walls just turning around, rotating endlessly. So much money and, so much talent on display.
Except for Cary Grant, because the person who was supposed to play them, David Yazbek, was out our performance.
Yes, except it's Tony Yazbek.
Tony Yazbek.
David Yazbek is the composer.
Oh!
No relation. Yes.
Oh, really?
But no, he was fine.
I mean,
he was perfectly talented. He's the dance captain as well, so he could dance the role too, you know.
It just, the show itself falls into what I've begun calling the King Kong trap of thinking, or maybe not necessarily thinking, but relying upon big budget wow factor, like the giant monkey or the giant screen at the back of King Kong. They were like relying on that to make it a good musical, which is what this does too. The sets are flashy, lots of moving parts, right? A lot of stuff gets projected on walls a lot. And it just is. There is a good idiom, and I will remember it if I just keep doing this motion with my hand.
And say,
I can't.
You got nothing.
I got nothing. It only works for you.
And even then, only occasionally. Yeah, absolutely. And that's, that's often a common complaint against, ever since the mega musicals of the 80s. I mean, it's been a complaint since time immemorial. This is melodramas in the 19th century.
Dang it, I thought I had an interesting opinion.
Oh, you do have an interesting opinion, Mr. Man. Listen, let me finish. Because, it's always, spectacle has always been seen to stand in for art, yeah, for substance, whatever. But you're right that that critique has taken on new life, especially since the 80s, since the advent of the mega musical, when shows became so expensive and there was so much, the technology basically got to a point because of computers where they could do so much of this flashy stuff. We're absolutely right, and King Kong is a perfect example of it. Puppet, incredible.
So cool.
For about 10 minutes till you get used to it, and then it's not that big a deal anymore.
Yeah.
The flash, the spectacle just gets old. It gets boring. Especially when all they can ever do with it is rotate it in different ways.
That's true.
And different formations.
That's really all they can do, which has been done so many times, so much simpler and more effectively. Like, I had a great example, and I was just thinking about it, and I forgot it.
What it made me think about was Time in the Conways. Do you remember that? Saw that at the American Airlines Theater a few years ago. It was one that takes place in the teens and then jumps forward 20 years. It's like a rich family in and then it jumps back in Act 3 20 years. Do you remember the whole living room set after the first act moved to the back? And then a whole different set dropped down from the top. And then you could occasionally see the set in the back, like through a scrim. You don't remember Time of the Conways, do you?
No, I'm sorry.
Oh, that's all right. I'll show you a trailer to jog your memory later. But that was, I thought was so, Time of the Conways didn't get a lot of love at the time. I think people thought it was just not, the play was too dated or anything. But I was blown away. I loved it. I thought it was such an incredible.
That sounds like such an amazing concept. That is a great example of spectacle adding to substance in right. the play if you thought the play was itself was also good, right?
Yeah, and because you could often see it in the back, it was just a manifestation of the way the past is always part of the present and the future, things like that, right? And they did some things like that in this, too. If you remember when they're on the trip in Act 2, you sometimes that wall into the house, that window became transparent.
And you saw their, dead family members that have been haunting them.
Yeah. Yeah, that was Claire's, right? She had the mother and daughter who had died of a car. That's I think, what she was mostly grieving.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. She was grieving the death of her mother and then soon after her teen daughter.
In both car wrecks,
yeah. Yeah, it was both her mother and daughter and then Aldous's wife.
Yeah. So they were all grieving. What was Cary Grant? He was just like...
His marriage with Betty Drake was failing and he was considering retirement.
Right. So it was basically First World Problems, the musical. And can we just talk about the fucking swimming scene for a second? Stop hitting the table. It's so... Speaking of the just utter lack... And James Lapine directed, too. Sometimes he can do well. I really liked the revival of Into the Woods from 02 that he directed, or 03, whatever it was, with the storybook trees and things like that. But so there's a part in Act 2 when the three men, Gerald Hurd, Aldous Huxley, and Cary Grant, go swimming while they're all tripping together. And the way that they did that was, stop it, people can't see what you're doing, it just sounds like you're vaping.
For all intents and purposes, I am at this moment.
So they're linked in arms, and then they arm in arm, and then they step out into the water, which was just like a blue projection on the floor. Yeah. And then they go out a little further, and then as the current starts to carry them away, and you can actually see a couple seconds of this in the trailer on YouTube, they just started like running around the stage arm in arm, apparently shouting stuff that was totally unintelligible. Could you tell they were supposedly like nearly drowning?
No, they were just moving around.
I eventually figured that out. But they were just like leaning. it was like a burlesque of a parody of
drunk people.
Of drunk people or like on a sea, like on a boat that's rocking around back and forth. But yeah, like drunk people.
Yeah, it's like people sliding down the decks.
They're just like running, like crab walking around the stage, and then eventually the fog comes up. Yeah. That's supposed to be like the water.
Yeah, it's amazing. There's fog. And, it's so good.
And projected water.
Because they like set up the walls.
Yes.
And the water graphics, for the record, just looked absolutely garbage.
Yeah, and so then you couldn't really see them because they're apparently nearly drowning, and then one of them saves them. And it's just this noisy, just utterly baffling scene that just goes on and on. I was in shock. Reader, I was in shock. Listener. So it's really just so inept. And it's unfortunate because it could be really rich material, this idea of, you know, of altered states of consciousness and thinking of a time when LSD was legal and how it was, you know, the way that it's... There's so many interesting stories to tell around this. They literally chose the least interesting.
And made it as uninteresting as possible.
And sidelined the most interesting character, not just because he was gay, but just reading a little bit about Gerald Hurd, he was a kook. He was like, you know, he founded this, kind of like David Lynch, he founded this meditation-based university in California.
A full-on university?
Yeah, it didn't last. It only lasted less than a decade. You know, he was super into Eastern mysticism, and he had all this kind of crazy stuff happen to him. But he was totally sidelined. I mean, he wasn't totally sidelined. I'm sorry. He was there. But on the image for the show,
he is nowhere to be found.
Yeah.
Even though there's a corner perfectly open for him.
He's just not famous enough, I guess. But in all the synopses, it makes it sound like it's about these three people. But he is there the whole time. And they treat him as just the plot glue.
Yeah.
And they give him, they don't really deal with his gayness beyond just he
lusts for Carrie.
Yeah, which is funny. Which was finally a joke, at least.
Yeah.
Like, I just couldn't believe, how do you make a musical about tripping on LSD so fucking boring? There were only a couple jokes.
Yeah, like the boringness level would have been fine in almost every other story.
Would it?
Well.
No, it wouldn't have been fine ever.
It would have been less not fine.
Wait a second. Okay, less not fine. Got it.
But the fact that it's about LSD just...
Yeah, that's truly shocking. And from reading interviews, they did that on purpose. You know, it seemed clear to me that they didn't want to go down the expected route of making it funny. Of, you know, they wanted to treat the story with respect, which is so unfortunate. Because you can treat it with respect, but still play the comedy.
Yeah, and still not do the expected.
Yeah.
Like,
and it doesn't have to be comedy. Lots of great stories are told without comedy. You know,
much to my dismay.
But oh really? What you think? Like Macbeth needs, like, would have been better with Groucho Marx. okay, actually, it would have been. Sorry, that's a bad example.
But like, actually,
hey, is it just me or those trees walking? But what were we talking about? Oh yeah, flying over sunset, la di da di da.
We would elbow each other every time they sung Flying Over Sunset.
Oh, yeah. There's like the title. The performers were great. Carmen Cusack sang the shit out of it. And even the understudy who was the dance captain, I was disappointed to not see Tony Yazbek, even though I then got some insider information that apparently he's a garbage human. But he is a wonderful performer. We saw him in Prince of Broadway. He did an amazing, if too long, tap number in that as well.
And he would have done in...
Which he would have done. And, you know, his understudy did fine.
Yeah, I like the tap number.
Harry Haddon Payton, is that his name? Harry or Henry? Harry Haddon Payton, who's adorable. He did fine too. He was a Huxley. He was kind of.
Not the other. Not Carrie, nor the gay. The other one.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. The gay. But then.
I'll agree. He was cute.
And he was in Music Man at Lincoln Center, and he was on The Crown. Like, he's just kind of that goofy. He's kind of like Wallace, but with from Wallace and Gromit, but with like a longer head.
And glasses?
I don't know. No, he doesn't. He wears glasses as Aldous Huxley.
Well, yeah.
The performers were fine. It was just such a shame that they just didn't really have much interesting to do.
Nope.
But speaking of sidelining the gay characters, never mention Cary Grant's bisexuality once. I feel like they maybe made a couple gestures in that direction. Oh, there was a part where he and Gerald almost kissed.
Yeah.
I just remembered that. What was going on? That was near the climax,
right?
I think
that was like when Gerald saved Carrie from drowning.
And then they almost kissed, didn't they?
Almost kissed.
It was just
Would have been so good.
Which was, yeah, they were clearly building up to it. But again, it's like they're too reverential. It's, you know, no one, even in this. So I guess we haven't mentioned that you've been reading the recent biography of Cary Grant by Scott Eyman called
Cary Grant, A Brilliant Disguise.
Which is what's the disguise? Oh, Cary Grant is a disguise for Archibald Leach.
Yes.
Yeah. So they're sidelining his bisexuality. The gay character is sort of a punchline, is barely there.
Yeah. His main additions are he introduces LSD to some of them. He chants and he lusts for Carrie.
That's true. His chants, they kind of use his chanting as for comic. I mean, it's clear that this was written by mostly straight people.
Oh, definitely.
James Lapine is straight. Tom Kitt, the composer, is straight. The lyricist, Michael Corey, I'm pretty sure is gay.
Oh, word.
I'm going to find anything for sure, but he's done a lot of gay things. Word. And he made the musical of Grey Gardens, so obviously he's gay.
Oh, no, yeah. Only the queers that take Grey Gardens and turn it into a musical.
So I assume that... Anything that was in there that was queer
was him.
Was his contribution, yeah, because it was very clearly I don't know. They weren't. Maybe it's just a case of I am not interested in the parts of this story that they were interested in, and that's it. Maybe that's just, you know, the things they're interested in is fine. But it's a shame because there's so much queerness there in the story
that could really be, like, fleshed out into something super interesting, exciting, and engaging.
Yep. But that wasn't the story they were telling, and that's fine for them. Whatever. There weren't a lot of people there. Tickets are available for like $29 on Today Tix.
Yeah. Not only were there not a lot of people there, half of them left at intermission.
Yeah. Not half, let's be honest. A handful.
Yeah.
But there were definite empty spots after intermission. I would have left if we didn't need to wait for our ride home. And if we weren't talking about it anyway.
Yeah.
I've walked out of much better shows than that. But I wanted to talk a little bit about our BiCon, Cary Grant, before we
stand.
We do stand. So you've been reading, you've become the sort of resident expert on Cary Grant. So why don't you tell us a little bit about his life? You know, before we do that, actually, I do want to, I feel like once we get going, you know, with the pan, it's easy to get going, just talk about how horrible everything is. But I do want to give the show credit for at least trying to do some things that were pretty experimental for a Broadway musical. Not innovative necessarily, but it was clear that James Lapine was trying to, in refusing the standard Aristotelian form, he was trying to do, to get at something that a little different than maybe other musicals do. For example, the way they used memory, the way that he brought the dead, the ghosts back in, sort of the way they moved in and out of the story. And even the touches like, for example, Cary Grant talks about how he's got a possible movie he's going to do with Sophia Loren. And then at certain moments during the trip, it was during the trip, wasn't it? They showed on the giant screens, they showed footage from Houseboat, from his movie with Sophia Loren, which hadn't happened at that point, of course. Yeah. And there was even a dancer who came out portraying Sophia Loren, like a fantasy version, right? Uh-huh. What it all was saying, I don't really know. But I do want to not get too carried away and at least give the show credit for trying to step outside of these boxes that we do tend to put popular art in. So we should give him props for that.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, they may have failed miserably, but at least they're trying. So tell us a little bit about Monsieur Cary Grant before we wrap up.
Okay. Mr. Cary Grant, who is solely an honorary Oscar winner, which doesn't count, and that was a major source of discourse in his life. He was born in Bristol, England on January 18th of 1904 as Archibald Alexander Leach to Elias James Leach and Elsie Mariah Kingdon, Leach.
Okay.
They were a very poor family, and the death of Archie's brother a few years before led to a somewhat oppressive and sad home life for Archie.
Was he the only child then?
Yeah.
Okay.
His mother started drinking because of the brother's death and was very much like a overprotecting, overbearing mother. And Elias just sort of was a never-present alcoholic. Early on in Archie's life, his father committed Archie's mother to a mental asylum so he could get a common law marriage with someone else and told Archie that his mother died.
Oh, I don't know about the common law marriage. They didn't mention that because they mentioned that in the play, right? His mommy issues.
Yeah.
Whoa, I didn't realize it was so he could marry someone else.
Yeah, and he spent a lot of time outside of the house, even at an early, late age, looking for work. He spent a lot of time looking for a job as a cabin boy so he could go travel.
Basically. Did his dad send him out to look for work, or was he just wanted to get away from the home?
Yeah, he wanted to get away because soon after Elsie was committed, they moved in with their grandma, who became like kind of cold to him after that. And so he never really enjoyed his life at home, so he just spent a lot of time outside of home. Flash forward. Archie is working on the docks on stilts, like as an attraction, because he was a very dexterous boy. He manages to join a traveling vaudeville group, which helps him fulfill his desire for travel. In the book, one of his quotes was, "If they had never clapped for me that first engagement I had, I would never have been ruined like I am." That was a paraphrase. I don't remember the exact
ruined
quote. Yeah, is but that I'm the pretty word sure he used ruined.
Hilarious.
Slowly, he ends up doing Broadway shows, like vaudeville on Broadway.
I believe. How did he get to the U.S.?
The vaudeville group. He spent, like, the group that they were doing spent time in England for their show, and then they added Archie.
And it was an American group?
I believe, like troops? I believe so.
Oh, I thought the way I understood was that his troupe, it was a British troupe that was performing in the U.S., and he just stayed behind. I think that's what this piece in the book says.
That's probably it. Okay. That is what it is.
Regardless, he ended up in New York.
In any case, he ended up in New York doing vaudeville on Broadway, but he ends up leaving the scene for Hollywood, and in the process, he changes his name to Cary Grant.
Did he come up with that, or did the studio mandate it?
He, I believe, came up with the name, but the studio did mandate a name change.
Got it. They didn't give it to him?
No. Slowly but surely, he doesn't really get any job offers right off the bat, but he begins accumulating experience simply by being around actors while they film and trying to make contacts and all of that. And his first film was This Is the Night. He was paid a measly $400 per week. His fifth film, however...
God, I wish I'd made $400. Oh, wait. Never mind, I forget I said that. I do make at least that much.
Are you sure?
Yes, I do. I don't know what I'm talking about.
His fifth film, Blonde Venus, was the one that got his career jump-started.
With Marlene Dietrich?
He starred opposite Marlene Dietrich,
sorry.
Who made 10 times as much as his measly $450 a week.
Yes, work, Marlena.
Also, if I'm getting like specific numbers or dates wrong, that's just because I have like a...
Doesn't matter, no one cares. Okay. No one will call you on it.
Okay, cool.
They've got Wikipedia.
True. His next big role was She Done Him Wrong, which was opposite Mae West.
So good.
Yes.
You remember that, right?
Yeah, it's the origin of her classic line.
And didn't we watch it on Christmas?
Yes.
Oh, no, we watched it the night before we left Utah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Whoa, that's surprising.
Yeah.
He got paid $3,000 in total for this performance, which was more than before. It was a major step towards a big shot status. He often lived with other male friends in these early days to save money, giving credence to the likelihood of bisexuality.
Were there rumors at the time?
I believe so, yeah. Finally, but his performance alongside Katharine Hepburn and Sylvia Scarlett was the turning point for Grant.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And a major breakthrough for him into the industry.
Oh, we got to watch that. We got to watch Sylvia Scarlett. It's so good.
Okay.
Even Katharine Hepburn can't ruin it.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, in the book, they say it was like a big win for gender fluidity, diversity.
Yeah, it's super homoerotic because she's disguised as a boy.
Yeah, and apparently she attracts both women and men.
Yeah, yeah. He gets this weird relationship with her where it's like he's taking her under his wing like a brother almost, but then there are a couple like parts where they nearly kiss where it gets really...
Yeah, they say that, like, all the homoerotic stuff was cool, but the movie itself, like, the actual technique in terms of the screenplay and whatnot was lacking.
Yeah, I disagree with that. I know that's a common take on it. I think they say that because the tone shifts a lot, and people can't handle tone shifts. They think there's something called tone that needs to be uniform. Consistent, throughout, which is such bullshit, and that's part of what I love about it. It's at one point it's a romance, like it's a romantic comedy. At one point they're escaping.
It's a romance.
At one point they're learning how to become circus performers. At one point, and I think that's wonderful. I love it because life's tone. Anyway, I'm sorry. I will get off that soapbox. We're running low on time, but that's bullshit. The movie is great. George Cukor, gay, by the way.
Yeah.
Kicked fucking ass. Continue.
No, they actually mentioned that in the book, and they said, like, at one point, for some kind of promotion, I think, they wanted George Cukor and... I probably said his last name wrong.
No, Cukor is right.
Oh, awesome. And Cary Grant, but then one of the objections was George Cukor is definitely gay and Grant is at Best Buy. and something about the Fae, they call them the Fae at one point. Fae.
George Cukor directed the movie called The Women, which is based on a play by Claire Booth Luce.
Nice
work. Continue.
Overall, his roles and opportunities do begin diversifying at this point, but he remains firmly in the world of comedy. Some of his other more dramatic roles in his career were Notorious,
mm-hmm.
None But the Lonely Heart,
mm-hmm.
and then later into, like, towards the end, various other Alfred Hitchcock films. Those first two I mentioned, Notorious and None But the Lonely Heart, were mostly commercial failures because they didn't want to see Cary Grant play serious. But he said that he really enjoyed that experience because it was something new, and it also allowed him to play himself, Archie Leach, not Cary Grant.
Got it.
He was married 5 times, and Phyllis Brooke, his second one, often got accused of being his beard.
Oh, interesting. And he only had, like, one kid, right?
If he has, I have not read that much.
Okay, I think so. I think that's what this thing said.
In any case, I do know that he always wanted a kid for a long time.
Interesting. This brochure that you can get at the booklet, whatever, pamphlet, whatever, at Lincoln Center, they make it sound like his failed marriages were due to the fact that of just trying to live this double life of being Archibald Leach and Cary Grant. I don't know enough to say this firmly, but I feel like a lot is made out of that, the idea that he was living two different lives. I'm not living two different lives, but that these two different sides of his personality were always at war with one another. I don't know. It's a little too handy, you know? Yeah. It's a little too neat of a psychological explanation.
I mean, they do mention that was, like, certainly a part of his, like, a major part of his life, obviously. But one of, I believe it was Phyllis Brooke, they got, I don't remember the specifics, but it wasn't just that. There was a lot more at play.
You mean, like, sexually?
Yeah.
Like the bi shit, the gay shit?
I mean, yeah, probably. But also, like, in terms of their relationship and then, like, their experiences with friends, for example.
I see. Well, but, you know, like, who isn't trying to outrun their childhood? Who isn't trying, you know, who isn't constantly at war with their upbringing, you know? So anyway, the point I'm trying to make is that it's even in this brochure that Lincoln Center gives out, they don't mention his bisexuality once. Like, what? Like, yes, okay, we don't have a confirmed source. We don't have Cary Grant on record saying, yes, I like dudes. Like, but why are we so... Well, I know why we are, but it's frustrating that it's so likely, but yet we still have to, like, tiptoe around it. You know, even in the play, they sort of barely mentioned it. Like, who gives a shit anyway? Anyway, why is he biconic to you?
Well, he's biconic to me because he was a very famous actor, obviously.
So you're a fame whore, got it.
He's hot.
Absolutely. No one would doubt that.
And he's bi, like...
No, I didn't mean to make you feel trapped or anything, but that's something to think about. Is it enough that they're famous, or what is it? What is it? Why do we choose certain people to be our icons?
Yeah.
And maybe it is enough that he's just fucking awesome.
Yeah.
And he's hot and he's in a lot of great movies.
Yeah. I don't think it's necessarily just his fame. He was very talented and very funny. Like, he was very... very good at what he did. One of his later films, like in the 50s, for crying out loud, he does a one-handed cartwheel.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, like, that's cool.
Like, and I'm like, bitch.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, he's wonderful. I love him. I've probably seen more of his movies than you, but, you know, you're also...
definitely.
You're starting a lot sooner, so I'm sure you'll end up seeing a lot more than I. But yeah, Sylvia Scarlett is so good. She done him wrong. Amazing. All of the Hitchcock stuff. Charade is okay. Charade is popular, I think, partly just because it's public domain for some reason, even though it's from the 60s. I'm not as huge a fan of Charade as some people are. But yeah, he's just so sexy. Even in movies I don't like as much, like The Philadelphia Story, which people love, but I think is not that great.
Too many conflicting opinions on the pod.
Even in that, he's just so cool and magnetic. Even in a movie like Houseboat, where he and Sophia Loren have absolutely zero chemistry. Like, there's no fire on screen between the two of them.
It makes no sense why they get together at the end.
Yeah. Maybe if there had been an ounce of chemistry, but, you know, it was their second movie together, and they apparently hated each other by that point anyway.
Yeah. But he's still, like, super funny and witty, you know. And he often had a major role to play in the actual production of the film, like wardrobe and script and...
Oh, yeah, nothing gay about choices. That.
Yeah, seriously. He definitely had, like, a major hand in all of that.
Like, later in his career when he had more power?
Like, basically, as soon as Sylvia Scarlett.
That's interesting. I had no idea that Sylvia Scarlett was such a watershed moment for him. Yeah. Because it
was a major commercial failure.
Yeah, and it would actually hurt Catherine's career.
Yeah. But I think that experience was a big bonding moment between Catherine and Carrie, and they have like a lifelong friendship.
Well, yeah, they did Bring in a Baby.
Yeah.
And did they do any others together? Possibly. I can't think of anything.
Yeah. So.
His Girl Friday. Have you seen His Girl Friday?
I must have.
I don't know if you're the new, where they're new. He's a reporter. He and Rosalind Russell. It all takes place in one day. Remember, there's a guy on death row that they're trying to say.
Yes, I have. And I've seen the remake.
Oh, Switching Channels.
Switching Channels.
From the 80s with Kathleen Turner and...
Yes.
And Dabney Coleman, I think, is one of them. And Christopher Reeve, right?
I think so.
That's hilarious.
But yes, I've definitely seen...
There's been a few remakes, actually. But yeah, so good. And that was Howard Hawks. Howard Hawks has such a light touch. So was Bringing Up Baby.
Yeah.
Which was perfect for him, I think.
Yeah.
For...
And what was really interesting was Carrie... put in a lot of effort to help his friends in the industry and newcomers that he thought would do a lot for the art form. He was a major reason why George Odets became a oft-hired screenwriter.
Clifford. Oh, interesting. Had he done work with him on Broadway?
I think so. Or at the very least, they knew each other.
Knew each other from the scene?
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. So he paid it forward.
Mm-hmm. And he did that for a lot of other people and, like, directors as well.
Work.
I think Douglas Fairbanks Jr. got a career because of him.
Well, no, he got a career because of Douglas Fairbanks Sr. But maybe, I don't know, maybe you would know more than I have.
It was because of Douglas Fairbanks Sr., comma, Cary Grant.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. Well, that's pretty biconic to me.
Yeah. Yeah, there we go. I solved it. He's a bicon, guys.
He is a bicon. It's a shame that the understudy playing him on some shows of Flying Over Sunset doesn't look the least bit like him.
Mm-mm. He has blonde hair.
Tony Azbeck at least somewhat has that sort of swarthy look.
Swarthy is such a good word.
And that physique, you know, like Carrie's got that great barrel chest. Maybe not a barrel chest. I don't know what you'd call it. But yeah, just that, you know, perfect physique.
C'est magnifique.
Anything else you want to say about your bicon, Cary Grant?
We stand him in this household. Go find whatever movies of his you can and watch them. He's very funny in it. Even in his earlier roles, like when he plays a blind aviator, but...
A what?
Yeah, he plays a blind aviator.
Oh, dear. That sounds...
It was like his third film. Don't judge him too harshly for it. But you should watch all of his stuff. It's really great. Even, apparently, his dramatic roles, he's apparently amazing in it.
Oh, yeah. We're going to watch him. We'll watch Notorious and Suspicion and...
What if he lost the Oscar for None But the Lonely Heart or Notorious, one or the other... to somebody else who was a World War II veteran who lost their hands in an explosion.
You've seen that movie, haven't you?
Have I?
Didn't we watch it? The Best Years of Our Lives?
I must have.
Oh, no, we were going to. We were reading that William Wyler book last year together.
Oh, that's right.
And then that kind of died and you were being grumps about it, so we never got to it. Yeah, from the Best Years of Our Lives.
Yeah. But in any case, Cary Grant said, where can I get a stick of dynamite? Because he was a Fable.
Wow.
He desperately wanted an Academy Award, and I don't think the honorary one did it for him, but...
No. Yeah, that's the consolation prize.
To end all consolation yeah. prizes.
But it's true. I mean, his type of actor often doesn't.
Because, no, yeah.
Because they're... What they do is so seems so effortless and is often so consistent. They're always playing a version of themselves that that people think that's not acting, which is a whole other discussion we won't get into. But awesome. And I'm glad you've got a new BiCon for your list.
Yes.
All right. Well, be sure and catch Flying Over Sunset if you need a good nap.
Yahoo! Woohoo! Or like a good excuse to get out of a prior engagement.
Yeah, you'd have to really want to get out of that prior engagement to put up with 2 hours and 45 minutes of that shit.
It's like you're getting like an endoscopy or something.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, wait, I'm sorry. I forgot I got tickets for Flying Over Sunset.
Are you kidding? I would much rather have an endoscopy because then I'm at least getting really good drugs. Well, thank you for listening. Find me in all the usual social spots. Join us on Monday for a brand all-new spanking closet practice. It's a spanking closet practice.
Is there spanking involved?
Not at all.
Oh.
Anything else you want to say to the nice people? Nope. Okay, well, have a good night. See you all. Love you.
We cannot keep doing this.
Bye. Adios. Bye. I feel like we're forgetting something. What?
Bye in Japanese.
Easy peasy lemon squeezy. What?
What were you thinking?
Bye.
Bye. Wait, what? I'm confused.
I don't know. I feel like I'm forgetting something else that I wanted to talk about.
One of the films that we watched?
No.
Okay, bye. What a great ending.
It's still-
Bye.
Oh, I'm lightheaded.
Oh. Just stop it. Just turn it off.
Okay, it's done. Click.
You're not fooling anyone. Bye.
This has been another House of Barbarism podcast, written, recorded, edited, and produced by Document of Barbarism, your friendly neighborhood mountain man fairy princess. Remember, there is no document of civilization which is not, at the same time, a Documenta Barbarism. Mwah.